Well, thanks a lot, Arun, for this nice introduction. I forgot I wrote about that. And it's great to be here. I'm really, really grateful for your invitation. So I'm going to talk about meaning. Let me just see. Maybe this is not going to be of much use anyway. But basically, I would like you guys to ask questions. I would do it in this way. I would most probably spend half the time in explaining why I think this problem is interesting. Quarter of the time, hopefully, introducing the system where we can do something specific. And the last quarter of the time, in when I would be most probably in specifics and you will be most probably sleepy. Okay? So if you really scuttle the part that is very specific to me, I really don't mind, because I would rather have you excited about this problem as opposed to seeing one particular case in action. Okay? So please ask questions. Okay. So, well, you know where I am. But roughly speaking, let me just, this is the boilerplate. You all know that we have sort of so many different tissue types in human body, and that's quite complicated, and it has fascinated biologists and physicists and chemists alike. You know, how does this happen? And of course, this happens despite the fact that every cell in the body that made, I don't know, the muscles, the gut and blood or whatnot, right, has the same DNA, right? The cells are extremely different morphologically and functionally. Okay, should I need it's on. Can you hear me on the back? You can, right? Okay, I'll speak up a little bit and point this way. Okay. Now, in fact, this question was in people's minds from ancient times. So, for example, Aristotle thought that the only way to generate this kind of complex body is to start with a small complex body and then just scale it up. So we see children grow, okay, come with heads and legs and feet and something, and they just change shape, but they all have the parts that are necessary. So, in fact, the thought was that at some point, that maybe semen already had, okay, the sperms already had in their head a little baby thing, right? And the ovum was just like a field in which it grows, right? So we kind of know now that's not quite the case, but people, when they got microscope, they actually started looking for this guy, and some even succeeded. Okay? They published the result. Okay, the current view is somewhat different, okay, that you start with a single cell, it develops into a cluster of cells, and then it goes through some enormously complicated convolutions, becomes a few layers of a little patch, right, that would fold and fold and fold into you at this moment, right? How it does it is one of the remarkable things. I mean, if you want to spend your time on one complex system, that's most probably it. Right? Partially, and you know, it generates all these hundreds of different types of cells, starting with the same DNA, same machinery. Right? How does it do it, right, is still quite a bit of a mystery. Right? Although developmental biologists have been, you know, digging for clues and finding many things out. And it's also technologically quite important. As you know, there is a lot of effort at this moment in generating different tissues from stem cells. And in much of that effort, focus has been on sort of, you know, what it says there, add different growth factors. So somehow create an environment in which it will be coaxed to go this way or that way. But the part that I feel should receive a little bit more attention is why is it just putting a bunch of growth factors on, say, a white blood cell would not make it into neuron easily? Okay? There seems to be something more than just changing the external conditions. Okay? In physics terms, you change the external fields and try to drive the system into some situation. There is something more to the system that likes particular states, that locks into those states. And this would be roughly what I'll focus on. Now, first thing, to talk about it, now many of you most probably are familiar with it. These days you can't read newspaper without knowing about DNA and genes or something. But I'll go over it and bore you for a short while, right? So, you know, you when I talk about gene expression, control of gene expression, you should know what I'm talking about. Okay, so here is a little picture of the DNA, and you know that there are letters like ACGT strung there. A part of it quite often codes for something called a gene. What that is some instruction for that will be copied over first on another heteropolymer called RNA, which is a string of attached molecules corresponding to ATP. Right? And then this RNA would come out and a machinery would read that to make an amino acid chain, right? Which will fold into some polypeptide, finally it will give rise to proteins, right? So this whole complicated system of starting with something that's on your chromosomes all the way to a functioning protein. And occasionally these days we are finding many, many functional things that will actually stop at the RNA level, doesn't have to go up to proteins. But basically, this is what much of molecular biology textbooks, okay, you know, they go on about it, right? And the reason this is not all done and one is still very excited about the whole process is that not just that these processes happen, but each of these steps of this process is highly regulated. So the cell can turn knobs on the rate at which any of these things would happen, also the rate at which these things can be destroyed, right? So the abundance of proteins or RNAs you get out of the same DNA can be tweaked by using some knobs, right? And much of molecular biology is the study of that process, okay? So I call this process from here to here gene expression, and control of gene expression means the abundance of these products could be controlled by having other proteins, other enzymes, other machinery activated. Okay? And I'll make it a little bit more concrete as I go. Okay, so this is actually, you know, I try to explain this and, you know, maybe I'll mess up. Okay? So the idea is that we know that the specialized cells, okay, that we see versus the embryonic stem cell, the gene expression patterns are different. Okay? And one way this has been represented by something that comes, some measurements that come out of modern technology called microarrays, is that you actually can measure abundance of different RNAs. So this actually is in red and green, but it was a matrix with numbers at one point in life. Okay? These indices are for various genes, and those indices are for various cell types. And high things got reddened, and low things got made into green. And just by looking at the color pattern, you can see that the expression patterns are somewhat different. Right? So, of course, you can do this kind of differences of cells, by causing differences in gene expression, right? Now, the real question is that why should there be any difference in gene expression? When each cell has the same DNA, you should think that, you know, there is some dynamics in the cell of gene expression. And if they all settle down to the same, if I leave them alone, they should hopefully settle down to the same stationary state at the end, and their gene expression should be similar. Why is it different, right? And of course, we need these differences to make a head and a tail and a belly, right? Now, how can you do that? Okay, so there is one aspect of it that has been understood in infinite detail in molecular biology or developmental biology, and it sort of gets attached to the name of Lewis Alpert, who had this idea that imagine you want to make something with a structure like a French flag, which is blue here, white there, red there. And one way to do that would be throughout the body or a cell or something, right, have a gradient of some chemical, now chemical X, right? It's high on this end and low on the other. Suppose you arrange that. And then imagine somehow the gene expression machinery reads out whether it is high or medium or low, right? It has some kind of thresholded, it basically is a function that's a thresholded function that says turn on gene X if this chemical is above a certain threshold. And then suppose I could arrange it so it will be blue. If it is above this threshold, then it's fine, and in between it's white. If below that threshold it's red, then you'll make a French flag, okay? So you can basically read out the gradient, read it out by a complex function, okay, and you can produce all these things, right? Now, you might say, well, so what is such a big deal about it? Is this really theory? This is a hypothesis of sorts, and when it was proposed, there wasn't enough molecular knowledge of how cells specialize and how different body parts become different, right? So, you know, people were not that receptive to the idea. But it turned out, maybe a decade later or so, by genetic dissection of how the fly embryo develops, right, especially by these two people, right, that actually early fly development is the French flag story repeated again and again. Okay? So it starts from the one end of the mother's egg, already is spiked with lots of mRNA of one kind, right? So you start from there, this end is different from the other end. And this, because it is different, there are, you know, cascades of things that happen so that the cells become different further and further down, right? Okay, so I'm actually not going to be focusing on this because developmental biology is full of discussion of how such things happen. And the basic idea there is that either that cells receive at different parts of the body, receive different signals, okay? And then there are whole auto sort of enzymatic cascade. So, for example, if there is a little bit of a particular molecule in high abundance here, it will bind to a protein called a receptor. That will change its enzymatic activity and do something horrible to another protein. That protein will do something, some other ghastly thing to another protein. And at the end, you will get some protein called a transcription factor that binds to DNA and changes the rate at which a gene here would be expressed, how much RNA would be made out of it, right? So basically, this machinery is a machinery where you are talking about input signals that tell you about body axis, right? You have high values either near the head, low values near the tail, or high values near the tummy, low values near the back. And then there are lots of machinery in biology that will read that out and produce very complex outputs, right? So that is all and good, and you know, we know tons of explicit examples like that. But what that also presupposes is that if I take a cell that will receive a certain signal and move it to another part of the body, it will forget that it was in a different part of the body and start responding to the new signals. Right? So if that was so easy, we could have taken another part of our body tissue and put it somewhere where I have an injury, and it will fill that part up, and it will regenerate all organs. Right? Now, that doesn't happen. And, you know, people know that that doesn't happen. But you know, in 50s or 60s, if you wanted to understand this, mostly what you had before are this sort of very generic picture. So this is Waddington, who sort of proposed actually the term called epigenetics, which is basically when cells can become very different without its DNA or without its genetic material becoming very different. Okay? So it's same genes, ideally should be same dynamical laws, right? And yet it is locking into very different states, right? And the way he started to think about it, he would actually draw these pictures as if there is sort of valleys and canals and things actually, a ball rolls down any of these ways and it stays locked. So there is some idea of a local stability there, right? But you might look at it and if you are too, you know, cynical type, you'll say, well, what is this potential? Meaning, when did biology grow such a potential? Right? And, and Waddington would sort of say it just means something, it's just a picture, right? At this moment it doesn't mean anything. But what has happened over last few years, well not last few, last few decades actually, we have learned enough and enough about how cells could lock, okay, their fate, okay? And now we can analyze the local stability without having to invoke a potential. Meaning dynamical systems can have locally stable states without there being a potential and it being a minimum of the potential, and you will see that explicitly in one particular example if I get to it. Okay? So, for example, one of the key genes that has this kind of property are the so-called Hox genes. They were discovered by seeing some strange mutations. Like, for example, this typical Drosophila fly has a big thing, which is a wing, and then there is these little stunted wings there called halter. Right? There is a mutation that makes it grow these two wings, and in a lab it can survive, but you can see it could be problematic for the fly if it does so. The same genes, okay, and these genes are expressed in parts of the fly body, so the blue part expresses a certain gene, the green part expresses a certain gene. Pretty much in the same order, very similar looking genes appear in the human body as the human embryo develops. Okay? And typically if you mess them up, most of the time the embryo would die, but in some cases you live, but for example, they play a role in deciding how fingers sort of separate, right? And you can get this sort of joint fingers or these very strange looking shapes, right? But otherwise there will be a major malfunction and you will not see a grown up person, right? So Hox genes have this property of stability. Once a cell, it turns on in response to all kinds of cues, but once it has decided that locus has decided to be in the on state or the off state, okay, if you move it around, it doesn't immediately forget it. It remembers its state even when the original cue has gone away. Okay, so it is guided into some state, but once it is in that state is very stable. The cell divides happily, there is nothing telling it to be different from the other, and yet it holds on to those things. Okay? So, So in principle, you can take a patch and put it somewhere else, and you will see, okay, the same organ repeated there. Okay, or the gene expression patterns repeated there. You should be able to move around a patch from one part of the fly to another part and not immediately lose, okay?
So they have
got mutations there. Sorry. Oh, no. That has nothing to do with this picture.
Yeah.
Okay. So this picture gets explained by something different. Basically, there are genes that are expressed on the backside that represses this halter, doesn't let it become a wing. And if you take away that gene, that repression went away. As a result, the halter grows into a full-fledged wing. Okay? Right? So this is just a Hox gene function. This has nothing to do with stability. Okay? It's just one of the key players in our development, and it has this stability. Nothing in this picture is explained or say that it is stable. Okay? Okay. So basically, this goes by the fancy name of epigenetic silencing. Right? What does it mean? So I've drawn some very funny, pictures here. Right? So this is my cell. This is my DNA. That kind of a funny looking arrow means there is a place where a gene can express, right? As if this is where an RNA would start being made. Right? When it's like left alone, it means the gene is being expressed. And when I put a cross on it, that means the gene is shut off. Right? Sort of commonly used biological notation, okay, right? And that arrow means this, and this arrow means that this cell, suppose it divides, in which case the parent replenishes itself, but also makes a progeny, so one cell becomes two cells, right? If the original cell had this gene expressing in large amount of RNA, it will continue to do so, okay? Where if it is shut off, it will remain shut off. Right? Now, if you think about it, that happening without DNA being changed is quite a miracle. Because when the DNA replicates, okay, lots of things has a way of reorganizing itself. Right? So if it is possible to arrange a high expression state, a low expression state, quite likely by the time you duplicated the DNA, rearranged everything on it, right, you would have changed the state. Somehow it doesn't. Okay? Okay. For many genes, it might switch, but some genes it doesn't, and we want to understand how and why. Okay? So, first, I want to say two things here before I go on and, get late on everything. Okay? So, these people wanted to understand for a long time, so they have been doing two things. Okay? One is, when developmental biology on mouse or something was pretty difficult to do, okay, people have been looking for simpler systems where a gene off, a gene on, right? Both being somewhat stable. They tried to look for examples elsewhere where this happens, right? And they found quite a few such examples very far away from higher biology of higher organisms. Okay? I'm just saying that this is sort of a stochastic system, right? There are lots of chemical reactions happening, molecules dancing in and out. If I leave a system, a Markovian system somewhere, it usually settles down on a stationary state, right? Now, there are Markovian systems where there are kind of quasi-stationary states where it hangs around for a long time before making a switch. So what I mean by bistability or multistability is that I have such states, where I hang around for a very long time. I sort of fluctuate a little bit around that state, right? But I make these big transitions only rarely. Okay? If I describe the system by some kind of deterministic thing, there will be multiple fixed points. Right? You will be drawn into one dynamical attractor or another dynamical attractor. Right? So even if you don't give, if you start from an initial condition, do you get drawn to one state, or depending upon where you start from, do you get drawn to two different states? That, in that sense, I'm sort of saying that they have to be, there has to be multiple locally stable states. Okay? Right? I don't know that I made it clear. Okay. The other thing is that the idea that that this should be a dynamical system with bistability has been proposed before, including people like Delbruck, okay, long time back. But on the other hand, you know, having concrete examples of it and being able to analyze it, okay, lay your hands on it, right, that was not easy, right? So it did happen to some extent. In several what are called prokaryotic systems. So eukaryotes have a well-defined nucleus, right, with chromosome in it. Prokaryotes don't. Most of the bacteria and all, right, they have quite rich genetic life, but, you know, they don't have some features that we have. But anyway, so there is a famous case of a bacteriophage, a virus that attacks bacteria, E. coli, for example, right, which injects, typically viruses inject its DNA, gets it into the cell, somehow gets to make lots of virus and kill the bacteria and goes away and sort of and multiply, right? This is called the lytic path, and this is what many of them do. But then there are some guys who are called temperate, okay, phages, who have two different strategies. Under some condition, they go down this route, and another condition, they actually integrate into the bacterial genome and grow as the bacteria multiply. Right? And if you look at the core circuitry of that, there is a little bistable switch in there, right? At least that's how people have thought about it. And this is actually maybe one of the first very well analyzed, even mathematically analyzed, genetic network that has a switching property, right? And roughly speaking, the way it seems that that thing operates is that there is a gene here. As these gene products are made, you get some proteins. These proteins bind as transcription factors near and affect the gene expression rate itself. So the product helps its own making. Okay? And if you have that situation, that feedback loop can stabilize this state. But it has an enemy on the other side, these purple looking things. If the enemy gets made, enemy actually comes and occupies those sites and shuts off this guy. So the brown guy and the purple guy fight it out among each other and act as a toggle switch, right? And this phase system has been sort of analyzed to death. It's sort of a popular example in systems biology. Now we understand its bistability, we understand its stochasticity. Maybe actually we don't understand everything about it, but at least it's received a huge amount of attention, right? Now, you can sort of call this class of mechanism what I will call cytoplasmic positive feedback, meaning you make a protein that floats through the medium and comes back and does something, right? One of the constraints of making little switches and memory elements, right, like toggle switches with this, is that each such switch needs its own protein. So if I want to turn this gene off, that third gene off, you know, I have a whole complex set of toggle switches to manipulate. I would need for each a favorite protein to do that. If it is the same protein that's being used for everybody, then they will all get locked with each other because they all float into the cytoplasm and come back to DNA, right? So it will be useful if I have a high complexity state to encode, right, to have, right, some mechanisms which can use the same protein but the mechanism is local, okay? So this is roughly what seems to happen in us for quite a few things, okay? So here is, again, a chromosome, and these little arrows represent genes. And you see silencing, which involves shutting off a big chunk of the chromosome, and along with it, maybe multiple genes that are in that locus. Okay? So you shut off several genes together. You can show that you can do that somewhat independently in different parts of the genome. Okay, they don't talk as much with each other, right? And they have some features, if you try to understand how that thing happens and what are the constraints and how do you model this. They actually have some features that are different from the simple example I showed you before, where A and B basically repress each other, and it's a very local mechanism, right? And it sort of is a little bit more physics-friendly problem in the sense that here is something that has to be bistable, that has to be local, and that has to happen in an extended region. So if you analyze that, some of the things you learn in analysis of phase transitions might come back to you and be useful. Okay? So, let me see, 24, Okay, so just to be able to talk about it, we need to do a little bit more background. Okay? First of all, eukaryotic DNA, right? We have like, you know, 3 billion bases, right? And you can multiply that by an angstrom or so and see how long it is, right? And if you try to pack these things, of course they are separate chromosomes, but that just saves you an order of magnitude, right? You try to pack it into a micron cube size little packet, right? And given DNA stiffness, it will be very hard, right? So what happens is that nature has provided us with compaction mechanisms. There are proteins which in fact spool DNA around it, and then a little bit of a linker DNA, another spool, right? You kind of put it in this sort of very compact way, and then the spools on themselves in some way that we don't fully understand. And this picture by now has most probably become inaccurate, right? But there is a way in which DNA is packaged in eukaryotic genomes, but turns out that the packaging is not the end of the story, right? That the proteins that go into making that little yellow cylinder there, right, have these little tails, right, that stick out, okay, from in between the DNA. And those tails are the place where you have lots of activity going on. That is, there are enzymes that will modify these tails covalently, and this covalent modification of the tails would be indicators for other proteins to bind, modify, right? There is sort of a rich life, okay, on histone tails happening. Right? And if we understand, so we need to understand a little bit of that to understand how you can have this some of the local chromosomal mechanisms. Okay? And the other thing to know is that if you take a nucleus and sort of, you know, maybe freeze it, slice it, stain it, and look at it, okay, at high magnification, and I know that this is too grainy, but you will see that these, you saw this kind of beads in a string kind of structure, you will see two different forms of it. Okay? Some of it looks like much more loose beads connected to links, etc. It's a more open configuration here everywhere. And some of these are very clumpy and dark, right? And a fraction of the clumpy dark things are on nuclear periphery. Okay? Now if you look at that, of course the traditional physicist's tendency is to say, well, so these things are called euchromatin. You know that gene expression happens more here than there, and this is called heterochromatin, right? And the traditional impulse of physicists is to model it as some kind of polymer transition. Well, maybe if I have polymers, I have some repulsion, some attraction, I tweak down the repulsion, maybe boom, okay, I'll have a collapse transition. Right? Now, it turns out by looking at it more carefully that it most probably is more complex than that, because nature hasn't invested, I think, okay, an enormous number of enzymes that tweak it in all possible ways, right? Just if it was just a simple transition to go through, right? So my discussion would be totally from the other end, where the polymer collapse happens on top of a chemical dynamics on the DNA, rather than polymer collapse being the main thing and various chemical modification being a function of it. And there are some evidence that if you undo this nuclear localization, this localization pattern, gene silencing happens the same way. Okay, so why are we interested in heterochromatin, euchromatin? Well, if you put a gene close to the boundary of a euchromatin and a heterochromatin region, quite often the heterochromatin boundary moves over and shuts it off, and it shows these epigenetic effects. So, for example, here is the East colony. Normal East colony would be white. If I started out with something that has suppressed gene expression, it will be red, but occasionally it will switch back to these white ones. And you can see from the pattern, the red cell divided mostly into red cell and white cells mostly divided into white cells. This has happened without any mutation. No gene has been changed. But yet gene expression patterns have been held for generations, right? So it's a phenotype that's heritable, but it doesn't need an irreversible change in DNA sequence, Right? So that's what is the definition of epigenetics. And this is sort of a similar thing happening in fly eyes, okay, for a gene called white. Okay? Now, and I told you about the Hox genes, so coming back to the stability question of the Hox genes, right? Genes that are expressed in a funny way from the tail to the head, which are very important for segmental identity. And here is a picture of how these genes show up in the fly genome, and here is sort of the mouse slash, you know, mammal equivalent, right? You know, we sort of begin to understand at this moment, right, how modification of histone tails and binding of certain proteins there can give this kind of stability. Why would a gene, a Hox gene that's on in this cell, would be on in the progeny, and if it is off, why it should be off? But it is not at still, it's not understood in enough molecular detail to make predictive theories, right? So what do we do in this circumstance? Well, we do what physicists do, right? Physicists, if they get stuck in a problem, they look for toy problems, okay? So they actually make up a model system. Well, if you are, so we always ask, what's the hydrogen atom of this problem, right? Or even if you are not feeling up to snuff, we say, what's the harmonic oscillator of this problem, right? And actually, biologists do the same thing. Right? And in fact, experimentalists do the same thing. Right? You always try to pick a system where there is least amount of bells and whistles. There is some techniques to manipulate the system. Right? You can see clearly what's happening. Right? And then, if you understood that, you can understand the bells and whistles later. So basically, you understand reality by stripping off lots of the reality. Okay? And then sort of focusing on something. Right? So when biologists say, I'm going to tell you about a model system, right? It actually performs the same function. It means very different things, but it actually performs the same function. You go to another system where you have genetic tools or some other things for getting greater insight, right? And you can learn a lot more, and then you can come back and take a look at the horrid complicated system, and you know how a core part of it operates anyway, and it's easier to understand the complex system as a perturbation of a simpler system than otherwise. Okay? Right? So I will go to a totally different organism that had no need to make heads or tails or hands or legs. Okay? Which is Baker's yeast. Now, why does yeast care about these things? Okay? Now, why it cares is a long story and several slides, and given the time constraint, I'll jump over all of this and tell you this is so. Okay? But actually, what happened was that there are parts of yeast genome, right, that is silenced. Some genes are shut off. And it is good for yeast that it is shut off. But you can mutate yeast in a way so that those regions suddenly become epigenetic. Right? So those genes suddenly stay on forever, or at least for several generations, or stay off for several generations. Yeast is, in some sense, our hydrogen atom we are playing with. Right? There is many more tools to attack it. Right? So if you understand something there and understand the issues, maybe we can come back and try to understand the issues in a more complex organism. Okay? So that's the hope. So, you really should not, I should not spend too much time on yeast, but point is that yeast, quite often, the one that you get out of, the stores is most probably diploid, like us. Chromosomes are in pairs. It can make haploids. So, for example, for us, the sperm or the ova would be haploid. It's half as many chromosomes. And, of course, whenever they get a chance, they meet up, okay? And they become diploid again, right? And quite a bit of machinery in yeast is actually dedicated towards mating, right? But that those machinery also has to be shut off in the diploid, right? Because, or if you make all the machinery there, right, for A-type genes and alpha-type genes, okay, it will look like a diploid, right? So what I mean by this is the following. Okay, so let me just go over all of these things. Okay, so haploid yeast has one locus in the chromosome for which either, let me simplify infinitely and say A-type genes are made or alpha-type genes are made, right? So if you're A-type yeast, haploid yeast, in chromosome 3, you will find some genes there. If you are an alpha-type yeast, you will find different genes there, right? Now, for some weird reason that was explained in the previous transparencies, right, it also has, the A-type yeast has alpha-type genes hidden there, right? But if it expresses that, it's as if it had two chromosomes, both with A-type genes and alpha-type genes, in which case it will be like a diploid and it will not mate. Okay? So the diploid yeast with the A-alpha diploid yeast doesn't do all the mating related things because it makes two products which together make something terrible and shuts down the rest of the machinery. Okay? But if I somehow take off, so in haploid yeast, this part is silenced. These genes are never expressed, right? It's covered up in all kinds of gunk so that you never see the light of the day, right? But if some reason that part goes away, that gunk goes away, and it is epigenetic, right? You can tell because for a few generations, the yeast were happy to meet, and then it changes to something, right, that would not mate, right? And geneticists like mating, okay? They can figure out very well. They control mating like hell, right, to say finally what's going on. So this is why this system was such a popular system with biologists. And we learned an enormous lot about silencing from here. Okay? So this is something... So haploid yeast cells, if you drop a little bit of pheromone in the market, okay, it gets very excited, it doesn't divide, and it makes this strange thing called shmoo. It sort of makes a projectile going that direction. Okay? Now, by whether things shmoo or not, you can tell that whether all those regions that are supposed to be silenced are silenced or they're open and they're producing stuff and making it more boring, in which case it behaves like a diploid and doesn't make any shmoo, right? But these days, of course, with single-cell imaging or something, we don't need to do any more of these genetics. We can see it with our own eyes in individual cells what the gene expression state is. So what you can do is that you can put a fluorescent protein in a certain locus, right? And if that part is shut down, you will not make fluorescing proteins, so the cell would be dark when you shine UV light on it. Or if it is expressing, okay, it will be, you know, green or yellow or cyan, depending upon what protein you put there, right? So here is yeast images taken in DIC. You see lots and lots and lots of cells. And you see only some of them are glowing here, others are not, okay? Right? Now, this doesn't prove it's epigenetic. We should really track it through several generations, seeing what happened when it made babies, okay? And also see that it doesn't fluctuate between on and off within a short time period, right? But you can now have, you know, directly assay silencing that was not as easily possible sometime a few decades back. Anyway, so let me come to almost the crux of the matter. So using these genetic tools and various technologies, people have learned an enormous number of things about the key players of silencing in yeast. Okay? And here is a sort of executive summary of it. Okay? So what happens on this? So this is, these are the same things again. So imagine this was DNA. Remember those the spools? They used to be yellow cylinders in previous picture. Now they are this sort of, this light oval-shaped things. Okay? These go by the name of nucleosomes, right? This is a histone core at the middle, and there's a DNA looped on it. And that green thing sticking out there is a little histone tail. Okay? Now what happens is that there is a place here where you get nucleation, meaning you get an enzyme that can modify this tail. So this tail just became red. Okay? Now for some reason, imagine the red tails like to get a seat to which more enzymes could bind. So okay, getting this tail red makes more of the enzyme E there. Okay? Well, it can get a few more tails red. Right? And you can go on and on and on and on and on and cover this up. So in out of literature, people would call it the railroad model of silencing. Okay? Very good. And I know this is a more civilized picture of it, right? In this particular case of SIRP proteins, silencing the genome, there we know exactly what happens. There are certain lysines which are deacetylated by the enzyme called SIR2, and that makes the SIR complex bind, and there's more deacetylation, and you go. Okay? So that's very good. Now what do you do with it? Okay, so first thing that studies produced is that some proteins are involved in nucleation, like SIR1, and some proteins seem to be involved in maintenance and propagation of this state. So we'll actually analyze more what are the constraints on this system, right? But before we go there, okay, maybe I'm just giving away the answer before I pose the question, right? You know, you can ask, what do you expect to learn from a modeling of this system, okay? Our traditional picture, and especially if you go to the biology community, quite often the expectation of modeling or from modeling is as high as from, you know, Newtonian laws for planetary dynamics, right? But, you know, in physics, modeling has many different forms, right? Some modeling is indeed supposed to produce very accurate numerical predictions. There are many other bits of modeling that doesn't produce very accurate numerical predictions. Some produce a scaling law, the coefficient is not known, maybe the power law is known. Okay? Some others produce totally qualitative statements about the system. So I was going to sort of say Landau theory is one such example. It starts with no knowledge of parameter. It says in pressure and temperature, what would roughly the phase diagram look like? Okay? What would be contiguous to what? Right? And in biology, what I would say has not been emphasized very often is that we could do quantitative models with qualitative predictions. Okay? So if I can do that, that's very powerful because that's how biologists have made a lot of progress. They had qualitative models making qualitative predictions. That's how genetics has progressed this far. Right? But what we was often underestimated is that maybe you can write down a mathematical model and pull out a non-trivial qualitative prediction out of it. And that would be about as valuable, something that you can't do just by arguing with words. Okay? And we'll try to see an example of that. Okay? So from this point on, okay. So the prokaryotic things, okay, this is the lambda switch, and this is actually a synthetic thing where you made an A represses B, B represses A, plasmid that you stuck into E. coli, right? These things have been modeled already, and we understand how to look at it. You write down the dynamical system, you look at its bifurcation diagram, okay, you sort of make some predictions, try to fit parameters, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, question is that what could we do here? And can we do a similar thing? And would there be some new features in here? Okay? And I claim there would be. So, now it has gotten late in the colloquium. I don't expect you to follow everything. But roughly speaking, this is the same picture again. Here are these nucleosomes. The tails are being chewed off. And some complexes are descending on it. And I basically, two variables, two order parameters, and two crucial parameters that I want you to pay attention to. The two order parameter equivalents are SI, which goes between 0 and 1 and indicates whether there's a silencing factor there or not. Okay? So SI half means half the time this is occupied. And second is AI, which is what fraction of acetyl groups are still there. Okay? And that being half means half of the acetyl groups have been removed from some tails. Okay? And I write down some equations in which there are two key parameters. One parameter is rho, and that says how many such complexes are available in the medium to drop down. And another parameter is called alpha. You know that when that complex drops there, it takes off these acetyl groups. Alpha is the rate at which it gets put back by some other enzyme. So having lots of S causes the acetyl groups to be A to go down. Alpha brings it up. So alpha and rho are parameters that are fighting against each other. Rho is how often SIR complexes, the silencing complexes, descend on you. Alpha is activity of a protein that undoes the deacetylating action on this, right? So rho and alpha are enemies of each other, okay? You can look at this system and you can ask when it becomes bistable and you have to analyze a little bit. I mean, there are already some twists in there. I'm not going to tell you what those are, right? But in this rho alpha parameter space, you can indeed get a kind of a fold bifurcation. There is this region where it can have two states, and you can stably hold on to two states, right? And this is the point where basically you have a cusp, right? And you lose bistability, right? And you know, at least in the phase transition context, that this is the point where, you know, noise is very, it's like the point of critical fluctuations, effectively. Okay? Right? Now, we can actually do better than this. You can do even in the most simple switches where it involves only finitely many variables. But we can do a little bit more here because it's an extended system, right? So, for example, if I had a equilibrium system with a potential profile like this, I could have asked of this solution which is of lower free energy, right? I have a totally non-equilibrium system. I can't quite ask which is lower free energy. But I can ask a question that is sort of similar to asking which is lower free energy, which is that if I make a little domain wall, okay, between the sort of silent state and the unsilent state, which way would the boundary move, right? So in an equilibrium system, the way on the average the boundary moves tells you which one was lower free energy. Okay, the lower free energy states wins over the higher free energy. But in the non-equilibrium system, you can always talk about front velocity, right? It doesn't tell you anything about free energy, but you actually know who will win if these guys are side by side. Okay? So using that, you can further bisect, okay, that bifurcation diagram and regions where, you know, silent, this is the region where silencing would win. This is the region where active region or unsilenced region would push out any silencing. So actually this model, which seems so easy and seems like leads to this railroad, actually leads to the railroad only in this little quadrant, little part, right? In rest of the points, it produces different dynamical behavior. More importantly, there is a region here, and depending upon whether you chose lattice models or a continuum model, it's either a line or a whole band where the boundary would not move. Okay? So this is a region where the domain wall doesn't move. Okay? So this is a zero velocity line. So I'll draw it as a line, but it can be a band in a lattice model, this red line. Now this red line plays actually a very important role. The red line decides. Red line is equivalent to in equilibrium problem deciding in a coexistent phase when the two chemical potentials are the same. Right? Okay? Now, if you think about it carefully, this is actually a very key player here. Why? Okay? So imagine I had this railroad situation, right? Where more and more silencing factors dropped and went on and on and on. You could ask, what would stop that process? Well, if I always supply more and more silencers in the solution, it will never stop unless there is some feature on the chromosome stopping it, right? But if you have a fixed number of proteins, what would happen is that you will soon titrate out, okay, other proteins from the solution. You will stop because you have run out of these proteins, okay? What that means is that I was modeling beforehand as if the silencing factor binding rate rho was fixed, but with protein number constraints, rho is not fixed. If you drop here, okay, you actually go back and be on this line, right? So, anyway, so the long and short of it is that you can pull out a non-trivial qualitative feature, qualitative prediction out of that, which is that if somehow I lower the acetylation rate, I go down this way in parameter, instead of going to an independent point here, I actually go down along this line. So, in pictures, what's happening? I have lowered the acetylation activity, silencing starts spreading. As silencing starts spreading, okay, it actually takes out silencing factors from the solution. So the result of lowering the acetylation rate is not better silencing at locally at some place. You actually get crappy silencing at many places. You get the silence phase spread out and become more inefficient at many, many, many places. Right? And as you go down this way, okay, what happens is that the system becomes far more noisy, fluctuating, and shows all kinds of dynamic features of going through a bifurcation, sort of losing the bistability from here. Okay? So basically, I'm going to spare you the details. So there is a protein here called SAS2, which actually when you mutate it, you see exactly this effect. And what we would like to do is to do it continuously. So, for example, this is what I will finish things with. Okay? What are these? These are little histograms. So, remember you saw a picture with lots of cells, right? And remember some cells were more green than the others, right? You could quantitate it, how green was this cell, right? And you can plot it in a histogram, saying how many cells did you see with high values between this and that and medium values between this and that, right? If I have an epigenetic system, of course, this is not a proof. We expect to see somewhat, you know, multi-peak histograms. Okay, we want to see a bunch of cells around high value and a bunch of cells around low value, right? Ideal case, we should see two bumps in your histogram, right? Claim is that this is sort of happening here, although this is not the ideal data, okay, for that. But we know from other experiments this is what happens. This is actually an experiment from Jim Broz's lab in Princeton. This is the case where there are lots of serpentine. It's like lots of rho. It's all shut down. That's no surprise. If you remove some of the SIR complex, this is nearly, I can call it rho zero, you see every gene is expressed. This is a mixture of two, roughly. SAS2, which is actually the control of the alpha, if you drop it, your naive expectation is that I've taken away the enemy of silencing, I should see more silencing. I should see something like this. But what you see is this wide distribution of gene expression. which is much more like as if this bistable thing, this system with two bumps, the histogram forgot that it has two bumps and merged it into one, right? This is actually what you'll see if you take an icing model, a finite size icing model, and simulate it, okay? You look at the histogram of magnetization, and you look at it below TC, you will see a bimodal distribution, the high plus magnetizations and minus magnetization. If you hit the criticality, okay, you will see it will actually merge into a unimodal, but a broad distribution, right? So I would say this is a rough indication, but really to prove that we are indeed going closer to the critical point of the system and losing things, we really need to track individual cells and also continuously change the parameter to see how things go. And this is what we are planning to do in our lab. Okay, so I think I have come to the... So these, many of these things are technical. I should thank my student, Mohammed Sadighi, who sort of worked it, and Vijay Nagaraj is doing the experiments in the lab, and Mark Gartenberg is one of the silencing guys. But I think I want you to take something else away from the problem, which is that in developing systems, there is a wide class of problems that are related to why do cells or organs or tissues lock into particular states. And analyzing the stability of these locked states and different patterns that can self-generate, right, hasn't been explored as much. It has been explored to some extent in ancient times, okay, following Turing or something, saying, oh, there, in some cases you get these bands or something. But it turns out that, you know, as you learn the details of the biology, how it happens, it's often not as simple as those, okay? So now that we know a plethora, we have a huge amount of data on molecules, their interactions that play a role in this kind of structures. We could do a much better job being predictive, not in the quantitative sense, but in a qualitative sense. Okay? So with that, I sort of finish this one. So would be nice, but even if we take at this moment two close by cell types, two different types of blood cells, or say glial cells and neuronal cells in the brain, right? Knowing at least the local landscape would be useful in sort of guiding things around. Meaning, for example, if you are doing hysteresis, right, and you did not know hysteresis existed, you just pulled things back and didn't find it, you might get frustrated. But you might know the equivalent of remnants or something if you knew the landscape, right? So I'm saying that in here, I would love to have that, but I would be happy to get even close by cells that are differentiated by a small network, right? Understanding there what the thing is, because people are trying to make them specialize. And at this moment, it's a crapshoot. You create a condition, you hope a certain fraction of them turn out this way. We have very little control about how to guide cells across these things, right? The grand picture is great, but actually a smaller picture even doesn't exist for most of the system. I would actually like to understand what happens to the polycomb suppression of Hox genes, right? Even if many, many, many genetic players are known there, okay, exactly how to switch things from a Hox gene on to an off, right? It's not been fully worked out. Okay, and I think we can begin to do that if we push this type of approach there. Okay, yeah.
I think quite a lot of cancer research is done in this kind of area, mm-hmm. in that if you start off with liver,
right.
and you get liver carcinoma,
right.
it's a turning on or off.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you have any information about that kind of transition?
So, look, it depends on what exactly. Now, some cases, there is a kind of epigenetic effect that I hadn't talked at all about, which has to do with DNA methylation. Okay? Now, DNA methylation, the current model is not a self-consistent something. It's just that if DNA methylation happened, maintenance methylases, okay, replenish the methylation. right? There seems to be an interaction between methylation and chromatin in a way that people have only started understanding now, and that might come back to the fold of this kind of models where errors are corrected because your neighbors are in the right state. Okay? Of course, in cancer's case, the errors are not corrected. It's a bad thing to shut off good genes, right? And there has been quite a bit of discussion about polycomb proteins, okay, being involved in cancer stem cell maintenance. So there is this idea that many of the tumors have some stem cell-like objects that propagate forever, and it's clear that the polycomb proteins that I was talking about, which actually shuts off or on these Hox genes, they play a role in keeping stemness. So people have actually been looking at epigenetic effects in cancer, both from the DNA methylation end and also a little bit from this end too. Yes. So epigenetics being important in cancer, almost everybody would agree, and people are beginning to see concrete examples of it. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Sorry, no. Right. So, in fact, very good question. And basically, I think I had the wish list, and we have actually done that. So, first of all, yes, there is. Okay. So, one has noticed so that many of these structures are fluctuating and dynamic. Not all of it is just KT, right? Because if I have a reaction happening, right, I have short noise in this reaction happening, right? So I say the reaction rate is K, but that means it's kind of a Poisson process with sort of random arrivals, right? So and we have actually done the stochastic version of it, and we are trying to now make the stochastic version the phase diagram. Of course, in stochastic model, really there is no different phases, right? There is only time scales of switching. And indeed, you get to see the same features, but there are some interesting twists on it, yeah, which I can tell you if you... But yes, the answer is yes. There is enough fluctuation in the system. And if you have the right system here, even if occasionally things fall off, say the silencing factor fell off and somebody acetylated it, depending upon how the domain boundaries move around it, you have also a stochastic chance of recovering that back. And that's where the domain velocities are very important, because if you accidentally create a little domain like that, right, it can snapshot again, okay, when the deterministic dynamics is saying the domain should move in on isolated things. But there is a very interesting question that's of great importance to all of this epigenetic silencing mechanism is, if I have a railroad model operating for you, that is, little bit of silencing produces lots of silencing, why doesn't it, part of our genome does accidentally not get silenced? So, and exactly why that doesn't happen, as far as I see, this model, if you look through it, there are two qualitatively different kinds of answers. One is that the nucleation probability is very small, but if that happens, okay, you know, you will get lots of silencing. The other possibility is that we are in the upper region where if I have a boundary between the silenced region and an active region would invade into silenced region, right? And I think it's actually a very good experimental, again, a qualitative question to ask. Is it because that nucleation rate is low that we are seeing most of the genome active? Or is it because even if accidental silencing starts somewhere, it's wiped out by domain walls moving in and removing it, right? And the answer, actually, nobody knows very well, okay? And the good thing about this model is that it actually posits it, okay, in a way that leads to two very different mechanisms, okay? But I think it's a fascinating question. What can you learn out of looking at noise in the system? And we have looked some. Okay.
I mean, I have a quick question, sort of related to, which is that, so these factors, and the control things that you had, control parameters, mm-hmm. They are external, or they depend on where you are
in the genome. Right. So that's actually
position.
I'm glad you are asking this question, because that's actually a fabulous question. So in fact, rho possibly, which is the availability of the SIRP proteins, is most probably similar everywhere. But alpha, which is the acetylation rate, has no reason to be the same. Okay, this parameter has no reason to be the same everywhere in the genome, because wherever you have gene expression happening, you get a higher rate of acetylation. Right? Kind of generic acetylation in some sites, but nobody says those would not end up acetylating the lysine of importance. Okay? So you could think of the genome having a profile of alpha, and therefore, see, earlier I used to sort of spend a lot of time thinking about whether the wild-type genome is this part of the phase diagram or that part of the phase diagram. It turns out, I believe finally, that what is true is that different parts of genome are in different parts of this phase diagram. Okay? So the active parts of the genome are most probably here. The telomeres is most probably there. Right? So if you, for example, it's known that if you put in a very active gene that's being transcribed at huge rate, like a tRNA, okay, next to a silencing region, it stops silencing. Okay? So enhanced level of alpha can kick you out of this kind of, bistable region. Okay? So I think that the right answer is that alpha is genome location dependent. Okay? So this phase diagram in some sense allows you to talk about different parts of genomes, okay, being in different qualitative behavior.
Thank you.